if you stand next to a modern natural gas pipeline, you're essentially inches away from a microscopic earthquake.
That's a great way to put it, actually.
Right, because to the naked eye, it's just this massive static steel tube stretching for hundreds of miles, holding back millions of cubic feet of just immense pressure.
Yeah, and we tend to look at infrastructure like that and just see a brute force engineering solution.
Exactly. You put a thick wall of metal between the gas and the outside world, and, well, you call it a day.
The brute force illusion is really powerful. We rarely think about the dynamic, like atomic dance happening inside that thick steel. I mean, the assumption is just that the strength comes from sheer
But
mass.
the engineering that actually keeps those pipelines from violently bursting isn't about thickness at all. It relies entirely on this hidden, highly coordinated microscopic world.
It really does.
And today, for a deep dive, we are taking a look at two highly technical, genuinely fascinating metallurgy papers. One is called Mechanism and Kinetics of Solid-State Transformation in High-Temperature Process Line Pipe Steel, and the other is The Effect of Niobium in Solid Solution on the Transformation Kinetics of Bainite.
I know, the titles are undeniably dense.
Oh, absolutely.
But the story inside them, however, it fundamentally changes how we understand the materials holding our cities together.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our goal today is to completely bypass all that academic jargon and uncover what is essentially an identity crisis within high-strength steel.
An identity crisis that lasted for years, I might add.
Right. We are going to discover how a tiny, almost invisible sprinkle of just one single element completely dictates the structural integrity of the modern world. But let's set the baseline first. What exactly is this material we're talking about? It's called high-temperature processed, or HTP, line pipe steel.
Yeah, so this is a very specific, highly engineered class of steel designed to meet strict, unforgiving specifications. Engineers know them as grades like API X75 up to X90.
Okay.
To put that in perspective, we are talking about yield strengths well over 500 megapascals.
And just to visualize 500 megapascals for a second, that is the equivalent of stacking dozens of cars on top of a single postage stamp, and the steel underneath wouldn't even begin to permanently bend or deform.
Whoa,
It
yeah.
is an astronomical amount of stress.
It is. And achieving that level of strength requires a counterintuitive recipe. Normally, to make steel stronger, you add more carbon.
Right, that's the classic way.
Exactly. But this super strong steel uses a very low amount of carbon. We're talking less than 0.05% by weight.
Which is almost nothing.
Right. So instead of carbon, metallurgists combine it with elevated levels of an element called niobium.
And the addition of niobium is actually this, elegant manufacturing shortcut. Because when steel is being processed in a mill, it's rolled out in these massive sheets at incredibly high temperatures.
Right, glowing hot.
Yeah, and at those temperatures, the steel is in a phase called austenite. You can picture austenite as the glowing hot, pliable state of the metal, where the iron atoms are packed into a very specific, tight, face-centered crystal structure.
And under normal circumstances, when you crush and roll that hot austenite, its internal microscopic grains want to constantly reset and recrystallize.
Like they want to bounce back.
Basically, yeah. But niobium has this unique property where it retards or slows down that recrystallization at temperatures over 1200 degrees Celsius, which is roughly 1473 Kelvin.
Yeah.
It freezes the grain structure in place while the metal is still piping hot.
So by stopping that internal reset, the steel mills don't have to apply nearly as much massive physical rolling force to shape the steel and achieve the toughness they need.
Exactly. It allows this high-strength steel to be processed in facilities that might not otherwise have the mechanical power to support extreme rolling forces.
It's brilliant from an industrial standpoint.
Yeah.
I mean, you get tougher steel with less mechanical effort.
It is brilliant, but reading through the first paper by researchers Yan and Podesia, it becomes glaringly obvious that this manufacturing shortcut created a massive scientific puzzle.
Yeah, the puzzle being an actual microstructural identity crisis. The steel worked flawlessly out in the field, but scientists and engineers couldn't agree on what to actually call the microscopic structure they had just created.
Right.
For years, the literature widely referred to the inside of this high niobium steel by a vague name, acicular ferret.
And the definitions for acicular ferret were entirely subjective. The papers described it loosely as a highly substructured ferrite forming by a mixed diffusion and shear mode, usually nucleating on non-metallic inclusions.
Which sounds like a lot of words to say very little.
Yeah, it was a catch-all term for something they didn't fully understand.
I have to admit, reading that made me want to push back on the scientific community a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because if the pipe holds the gas and the steel does its job perfectly out in the real world, why does it matter what we call the microscopic arrangement of the metal?
I see where you're going with this.
It feels like arguing whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable while you're in the middle of eating a great pasta sauce. You know, who cares? As long as it works.
This raises an important question. It's incredibly tempting to think that if the macroscopic properties are good, the microscopic labels are just academic trivia.
Right.
But relying on a subjective, unproven name like acicular ferrite is a ticking time bomb for engineers.
Wait, really? A ticking time bomb?
Yes, because if they don't actually know what the atomic mechanism of the metal is, that means any calculations they run on how it handles heat or stress are basically just educated guesses.
Oh, wow.
Imagine a crew is out in the field welding a damaged pipe. They could inadvertently shatter the metal because they used the wrong mathematical formulas for how the steel reacts to heat.
Ah, I see. That is the exact danger. Welding creates what we call heat-affected zones, or HAZ. The metal immediately adjacent to the 3,000-degree welding torch undergoes a violent temperature spike, followed by rapid cooling.
Exactly. And if your understanding of the steel is just a vague label based on what it looks like under a basic microscope, you cannot predict how its internal structure will rearrange during that thermal shock.
You are basically flying blind.
You're flying blind, just hoping that the newly welded joint won't violently crack under 500 megapascals of pressure once the gas starts flowing again.
So to solve this identity crisis and prevent those kinds of catastrophic failures, Yan and Badesia needed undeniable proof of what this metal actually was. And standard optical microscopes simply do not have the resolution to decipher atomic mechanisms.
Right. They aren't powerful enough.
They had to measure the steel's microscopic mountains.
I love that phrasing. The experimental setup they used is pure high-tech detective work. They utilized a piece of equipment called a thermic master simulator combined with an atomic force microscope, or AFM.
We should probably explain the AFM because it's not a microscope in the traditional sense where you look through a glass lens.
No, not at all.
It works more like a hypersensitive record player needle. It uses a microscopic cantilever to physically trace the surface of the sample.
Yeah, it is so sensitive it can feel the topological bumps of individual atomic shifts.
So instead of just taking a picture, they essentially ran a topographical map over the metal to find microscopic earthquake fault lines.
Exactly. They took a polished sample of the HTP steel, heated it to 1533 Kelvin inside a complete vacuum so no oxidation would ruin the surface.
What?
Then they let it cool and drag that microscopic needle across it. They were looking for the physical topographical evidence of how the atoms moved when the steel transformed from its glowing hot austenite state down to its final room temperature state.
And what that atomic force microscope revealed was a surface relief featuring an invariant plane strain, which we definitely need to translate for everyone.
Yes. An invariant plane strain means the atoms weren't just randomly diffusing or wandering around individually to form the new crystal structure.
Like people mingling at a party.
Right. It's not like that. Instead, they were moving with coordinated military-like precision. Imagine a whole massive block of atoms shifting simultaneously.
All right.
This causes a physical shear. It's a literal shape deformation on the surface of the metal.
Like a microscopic tectonic plate physically sliding upward and creating a geological ridge.
That's a perfect analogy. And the researchers measured the angle of that microscopic ridge, finding the shear component to be at least 0.24.
Which is huge, right?
It is. In geometry, that means the crystal lattice skewed dramatically, like a rectangle being pushed over into a severe parallelogram.
Wow.
In the world of metallurgy, a measurable shear of 0.24 is the ultimate smoking gun. It tells you definitively that this is a strain, energy-dominated, displacive transformation.
And the big reveal from this smoking gun. Because of this military precision atomic shifting, the structure is definitively bainite. It is absolutely not acicular ferrite. The whole industry had been using the wrong classification.
Yeah.
And they mapped out that this bainite forms specifically between 773 and 923 Kelvin, or roughly 500 to 650 degrees Celsius.
Proving it is bainite fundamentally overhauls how engineers treat the material. You see, acicular ferrite implies the metal nucleates randomly on non-metallic dirt in the steel in a messy starburst pattern.
Right.
Bainite, on the other hand, grows as highly organized parallel plates through that specific shear mechanism.
The physical scale of these plates is an incredible aha detail for me. We're talking about massive pipelines, and their immense strength comes from these plates of bainite that are incredibly thin, only about 0.2 micrometers thick.
It's mind-boggling.
You can fit hundreds of them across the width of a single human hair.
And the reason they stay so unimaginably thin is due to a fascinating mechanical roadblock. When that block of atoms shifts to form a bainite plate, it physically pushes against the surrounding high-temperature austenite. At those temperatures, the austenite is relatively soft.
Huh.
It yields to this shape change and undergoes plastic relaxation.
It basically gets crushed out of the way.
Exactly. That crushing action creates a massive amount of microscopic debris physical dislocations in the crystal lattice, and that debris actually acts as a solid barrier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it violently stops the bainite plate from growing any longer or wider. It is a brilliant self-limiting mechanism. The transformation literally creates the roadblock that stops its own growth, constantly refining the microstructure and keeping everything microscopic and tough.
That is so cool. And there is another crucial detail tied directly back to that secret recipe we mentioned at the start, the super low carbon content of less than 0.05%.
Right, the carbon is key here. As those bainite plates shear and form, carbon doesn't fit well inside them, so they push whatever carbon is left over into the remaining pockets of austenite.
Makes sense.
Eventually, that leftover carbon-rich austenite decomposes into particles of cementite. Cementite is an iron carbide. It is incredibly hard, but it is also as brittle as glass. Yeah, if you have coarse, large cementite particles scattered throughout your pipeline, it ruins the steel's toughness by giving microscopic cracks an easy, brittle path to follow.
But because our HDP steel starts with a ridiculously low carbon footprint, those cementite particles end up being microscopic. They're so tiny that they don't compromise the toughness at all. It's the perfect metallurgical balancing act.
It really is. Resolving that identity crisis and proving the metal is bainite is a massive leap forward, but it immediately introduces a new, even bigger logistical mystery, which brings us to the findings of the second paper.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If Yana Videshi approved we have this ultra-tough bainite, well, that creates a metallurgical headache.
It does.
Because bainite usually takes quite a long time to form at these temperatures. So how are these steel mills churning out miles and miles of pipelines so fast? That brings in the second study by Rees, Perdrix, Morix, and Padacia, focusing on that mysterious elevated niobium. When I first read about adding niobium, I assumed it just sat in the metal and made it tougher, sort of like putting steel rebar in concrete to reinforce it.
A lot of people think that.
Right. But this paper proves niobium has a split personality. It has two completely different jobs depending on its physical state.
Niobium does not act like structural rebar. It acts entirely as a kinetic controller. Its behavior completely flips depending on how it interacts with the iron atoms around it.
Let's break down state one, which the paper calls solid solution. This is when the individual niobium atoms are completely dissolved and scattered randomly throughout the hot austenite.
Exactly.
You can picture it like sugar perfectly dissolved in a hot cup of tea. You can't see the sugar, but it's mixed into the liquid.
That's a good way to look at it. When it is in this dissolved state, the researchers found that niobium actually retards or slows down the transformation to bainite. It essentially hits the brakes.
Okay.
One of the ways it does this is by suppressing the formation of softer, undesirable structures like allotriomorphic ferrite.
Allotriomorphic ferrite being those blocky, structurally weak crystals that try to form at the borders of the grains, creating weak links in the metallic chain.
What's fascinating here is that while dissolved niobium suppresses those weak links, its overall breaking effect on the bainite is actually quite subtle.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The researchers had to use specialized equipment called a dilatometer just to measure it.
Right, a dilatometer.
A dilatometer is highly sensitive. It measures microscopic expansion and contraction because crystal structures physically take up slightly different volumes when atoms rearrange themselves.
So dissolved niobium slows things down slightly. But then we look at state two, carbide precipitates.
If the steel is held at high temperatures, specifically around 900 to 950 degrees Celsius, for a certain amount of time, the thermodynamics shift.
Okay, so sticking with our tea analogy.
Right, just like how sugar will crystallize at the bottom of a teacup as the tea cools because the liquid can no longer hold it, the dissolved niobium atoms start to clump together with carbon and nitrogen. They precipitate out of the solid solution to form tiny distinct particles called niobium carbonitrides.
And when this precipitation happens, the effect completely flips. It dramatically accelerates the transformation to bainite. The steel transforms incredibly fast.
The acceleration happens because those tiny carbonitride particles act as highly effective nucleation sites.
It's less like a thermostat simply tuning the dial up, and much more like cloud seeding in the atmosphere.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Yeah, just like a dust particle gives water vapor a physical surface to cling to and condense into a raindrop, that tiny carbonitride particle gives the shifting iron atoms a physical foundation to start building the bainite plate.
Exactly. Instead of the atoms struggling to organically initiate that complex military-style shear shift in the middle of nowhere, the niobium particle essentially says, "Start building here."
Wow.
The energy barrier drops, and the steel transforms into bainite at an accelerated rate. The entire speed of the structural transformation is entirely dependent on the specific temperature and how long the metal sits at that temperature.
So, what does this all mean? We aren't all metallurgists managing cooling cycles in a steel mill. Why does the difference between dissolved niobium and precipitated niobium matter to us?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it goes back to the dangerous reality of building infrastructure in the field.
Right.
You have these massive 40-foot lengths of pipe, and to build a pipeline across a continent, you have to weld them together, often in terrible weather conditions, far away from the controlled environment of a factory.
Which creates those volatile heat-affected zones we talked about earlier.
Precisely. When a welder's torch hits that joint, it creates a wildly complex thermal gradient. The steel, a millimeter away from the weld, gets heated almost to its melting point.
Okay.
The steel an inch away gets very hot, but not melting. The steel 6 inches away barely gets warm. Every single fraction of an inch away from the weld experiences a completely different combination of time and temperature.
And because of that second paper, we now know that those exact microscopic variations in time and temperature are what dictate whether the niobium in the steel stays dissolved or if it precipitates out into those cloud seeding particles.
Yes. If a specific pocket of the heat-affected zone hits just the right temperature for just long enough to allow even a tiny fraction of that niobium to precipitate, the hardenability of that exact spot will be drastically different from the metal half an inch next to it.
That sounds dangerous.
It is. The bainite will form at entirely different speeds, creating a dangerous mismatch in structural integrity.
Which means the final strength of the joint could be totally compromised, leading to a catastrophic blowout. By finally proving the steel is actually bainite and proving that niobium is acting as this kinetic cloud seeder, engineers aren't just crossing their fingers and hoping an acicular ferrite holds up under pressure.
Exactly.
They can precisely calculate and anticipate these massive variations based on the exact heat cycle of the welding torch. They can design preheating and post-heating welding protocols that guarantee the pipeline won't fail.
It brings a profound level of scientific predictability to an industrial process that is absolutely critical for global safety and energy infrastructure. The safety of the macrostructure relies entirely on mastering the invisible microstructure.
It's an incredible journey of discovery. We started with this mysterious, super tough steel that the entire industry was misunderstanding and mislabeling. Then, using atomic force microscopes to map out tectonic-like surface ridges, scientists definitively proved its strength comes from the military precision atomic shifts of bainite.
Beautifully summarized.
And finally, we discovered that niobium, an element taking up less than the tenth of a percent of the whole alloy, is acting as a microscopic traffic cop. Depending on whether it's dissolved or clustered into tiny seeds, it single-handedly dictates the speed at which the structural foundation forms.
It's a beautiful piece of scientific detective work that directly impacts the physical safety of the world around us.
The next time you drive past a pipeline construction site or see a massive piece of steel infrastructure, remember that its brute force strength isn't just about thick metal. It relies entirely on the precise, coordinated movements of atoms that are fractions of a micrometer wide, guided by a tiny sprinkle of niobium.
It leaves you wondering about the immediate future of this infrastructure, too. As the world rapidly transitions toward clean energy, there is a massive push to pump hydrogen through these exact same steel pipelines.
Oh, right.
But hydrogen atoms are the smallest in the universe. They are small enough to slip right into these microscopic tectonic fault lines and cause severe embrittlement. Will this beautiful atomic architecture of bainite and niobium hold up to the chemical demands of the hydrogen age? Or are we going to need a completely new microscopic revolution just to keep the lights on?
It really makes you look at those massive static tubes in a whole new light. The atomic dance inside them isn't over. It might just be preparing for a brand new routine.